Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Jennifer Waits.
Hi, I'm Paul Rees-Mindell.
And I'm Eric Klein.
We've got World College Radio Day coming up on October 6, 2023. And in honor of that, we're going to dig into the history of college radio on today's episode. It should be no surprise to Radio Survivor listeners that I'm a huge college radio fan and a chronicler of college radio history. And in particular, I like to remind people that college radio stretches back to the earliest days of radio. I've been doing more research about the early days of college radio and was excited to present a paper on that very topic this past spring at the Radio Preservation Task Force Conference at the Library of Congress. We're going to talk about some of that research today and also about what the future holds for college radio. So excited to be back with you both again, 2 weeks in a row, Eric and Paul.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And it's Jennifer, it's always good to be here with you on Radio Survivor to learn more about college radio from you. It's a cliche here on Radio Survivor at this point, but there was college radio was not getting the credit it deserved in the landscape of radio history until you shone a light on it. It feels like that for me, at least, right? I found out how important college radio was to the whole history of radio, learning from you and then finding out all about that history from the other experts you've brought on to Radio Survivor. So it's always fun to talk college radio with Jennifer Waits.
So you mean that college radio was important before they discovered the cure in Nirvana?
I know, it's crazy, isn't it?
Right. Yeah, like before the 80s.
I feel like I'm always battling that stereotype of, college radio started in the 1980s. And, so I'm interested in the entirety of the history of college radio. But after going to a college that had a student radio station that started in 1923, that really opened my eyes that college radio had a much deeper history, went further back than most people realize. So now I feel like I'm this cheerleader, this constantly reminding people, like, don't forget about the 1920s. Because even when college radio histories were written, decades ago, there was a book written about campus radio, carrier current radio, that started in the late 30s. And they didn't even give much attention to the 1920s. It's like that era just got completely erased.
Yeah.
So that really has gotten into my craw. And it's like probably the most difficult period of college radio history to research. So, of course, I decided to take that on for this paper that I gave at the Library of Congress. And, there's no one source for information. You have to really dig into a whole bunch of different places to get these tiny little anecdotes about what was happening amongst students at that time. And that's my passion, is student-run stations and student-led efforts in radio. There's been a lot of great research about how public radio is really, but the deep history of public radio stretches back to radio activities on college campuses. But a lot of those stations were, efforts more of the adults versus the kids. So kind of like when I started writing about college radio on my blog, Spinning Indie, I started writing these profiles. I did this 50 state tour series where I was profiling stations in every state. And often I would look for stations that were under the radar, more like the underdog stations that not everybody was writing about, because I like to, kind of share that college radio comes in all shapes and sizes. And we don't have to always write about the stations that have the huge wattages and that are in big cities. I think it's interesting to look into some of these niche stations, too. So that's kind of why, this emphasis on student-run stations in the 1920s and student radio activity.
But of course, you cited it yourself that this is difficult research to do, right? So I think we can sort of forgive the myopia, right? Because of the fact that it is not well documented. And I think college radio sits at a funny place, right? Because, you know, is there someone writing the history? Maybe they are, of, you know, college a cappella groups. Is there somebody writing the history of college, you know, internal drama clubs, right?
Chess club.
You know, chess clubs, right? And maybe somebody is, but often I'm sure that they don't get their due either, right? Because, you know, often they're extremely opaque to anyone who's not on a campus. And college students, of course, spend, you know, on average 4 years at the activity at best, and then they move on. And you're so busy doing, who's got time to document? Who's got time to write about it or do any sort of documentation? And even, you know, we think, oh, there would be websites and such. Well, that, you know, these days that's ephemeral. They get changed and there's maybe no record of that website as existed 5, 10, 15 years ago. Radio is a little different because so many of these stations are intended to be heard off campus at some point. Not all of them, right? Not all of them, as we may talk about a little bit later. But so many of them are, and they have that sort of more public, private kind of, they straddle that line in a way that I think a lot of other activities on a college campus don't. But you know, I think probably the only thing that's probably more well documented are, you know, yearbooks and newspapers, simply because they're not ephemera in the same way, because they're fixed into physical objects that usually get saved somewhere on campus or end up in somebody's file folder somewhere.
Right. Which so, I imagine, so I
guess there's
probably the most rich source to mine for information about college radio, especially in the 20s, would probably be student newspapers.
Oh, you know,
who might
definitely
cross the hall,
yes,
and cover themselves, you know, cover their classmates
and
doing
yearbooks.
Radio.
And often, yeah, some of the people doing radio were also involved with the newspaper or the yearbook, and sometimes editor in chief. I feel like I found this. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've seen this multiple times. But Paul, I think, makes an interesting point about, you know, the radio stations, college radio stations, that maybe could be heard off campus versus those that were really only heard on campus. And I think that complicates some of the histories that we read of college radio too. You know, in some cases, those campus-only stations are kind of ignored, you know, because it's not part of this bigger narrative. But I like to think of them as being all part of the same story, even though there are obvious differences. Even if you were a campus-only radio station in the 1980s, you still had interactions off campus with the music industry. Like, you might have been reporting to CMJ Music Journal, you might have been going to conventions, you may have had connections with your local record shop. So there were still, they still weren't, you know, completely, they still had connections off campus in a way that maybe some other student organizations had less intersection with, you know, the broader community. So for this, you know, the Radio Preservation Task Force conference, this most recent one, was supposed to be in 2020, and it was going to be kind of this, you know, if you think of 1920 as one of the key dates in radio, that some people might say was the beginning of commercial radio, but highly debatable. So, you know, it was exciting to have that as a centennial conference. But then with the pandemic, it got pushed to 2023. And for me, I was excited because that meant it was the 100th anniversary of the launch of the first student station at my college at Haverford. So I think that was even more impetus for me to kind of reflect back on these 100 years. And Haverford's wasn't the first college radio station, but it was certainly one of the very early, completely student-run, student-built initiatives. So it was students who were already radio amateurs before they came to campus. And, you know, they were part of this radio club that ended up building the station. And after 4 years, they were the ones that decided to sell the station too. So it was a total student enterprise. And so that's kind of my big research area, is to find more and more of these very student focused stations from the 20s. And I haven't found all that many, because it's so, you have to research kind of station by station. But I think it's really inspiring to hear these stories and to, you know, be reminded of what students can do. And it's the case today, too. And 100 years later, when I meet students who are running their college radio stations, it's very inspiring. So I think a lot of times people who are outside of a college community might not realize kind of the level at which students are involved with student clubs and the things that they're doing and the risks they're taking, the experiments they're doing. It's very inspiring.
Well, the 1920s, you know, we have to take into account radio was experimental in many ways. Broadcast voice radio in particular, right? Because radio, not very soon before that, was only telegraph, essentially. But, you know, also, you know, we're talking about radio in terms of voice radio would have been only in the AM band, which, and you would have been using tube-based equipment, which in many cases was difficult to assemble. Probably they were assembling these transmitters in many cases themselves, homebrewing them because they were experienced as hams, as amateur radio enthusiasts. There was not a robust market of off-the-shelf transmitters as there would be today. AM radio also, if you're broadcasting at any amount of power, can require some space for the antenna. Can, you know, overall, like there's many, I think, technical and probably just monetary capital challenges to having a radio station in the 1920s that would be very different from 40 years later, from say the 1960s into the 1970s. That we have to kind of take into account is probably one reason why you have difficulty finding these stations is that, you know, I wonder how many actually did exist or would exist given these particular challenges. And to what extent, because this was a period of in which radio was lightly regulated compared to after 1934 and the Communications Act. Not that it was not fully unregulated at that time, but the regulations were different. You know, I'm certain it's sort of looking at unlicensed radio. There's probably, it's similar to that. There's probably stations that are simply barely documented at all because they may have been operating with a limited degree of authorization from, you know, either federal authorities or perhaps even campus authorities.
Right. And there were, and I don't have the number on hand at the moment, but there was a pretty large number of licensed college radio stations in the 1920s. But some of those were only on the air for a few months too. So you also have that part of the equation where, you know, you had stations that didn't exist for a long period of time. But while I was doing research for this presentation, I really started to dig into amateur radio because at Haverford, there were sort of simultaneous things happening. There was an amateur radio club and the radio station, the broadcast station grew out of that.
Can you define amateur radio? Because we're talking about it here and you know, someone hearing it and is not familiar with it may think, well, that's just someone who's doing radio and not paid for it, right? So, yeah. But it's actually it's a class of radio. And I think probably specifically as we try to distinguish between sort of amateur radio and college radio, it's important to draw that line.
Yeah. So in the amateur radio clubs, students were doing experiments and a lot of the club focused on doing communication with other radio stations. So it was like point-to-point communication where you would try to talk to somebody else. I mean, more like a telephone or ham radio.
I mean, I think amateur radio, by definition, cannot be broadcast, meaning yeah. I think it's only for point-to-point communication, not just full monopolizing a frequency for a time.
Technically, yeah. And then, technically. Yes. So when you read about some of these early radio clubs on campuses, they were teaching each other how to do Morse code. They were offering to send messages to people across the land or across the country. And it was those kinds of experiments. And at Haverford, so they were doing things like that. And it was through that club that they did an international chess match by radio with Oxford in the 1920s. But at the same time, the club also launched
Oxford in England.
Yeah.
Oxford University in across the pond, as they say, in England. Yes. Just want to draw that out. Not Oxford, Mississippi or Oxford, Ohio.
Yeah. They were written up in the New York Times, and it was thought to be the first intercollegiate, you know, interoceanic chess match by radio. You always have to get very specific in your first claims. And so they were doing that, but they were also built a broadcast station that was licensed by the FCC over AM, WABQ. So it's interesting. It was interesting to me to think about, and I realized I had to really kind of tease out a lot of stuff. I visited Union College, and that was, we talked about that on one of our episodes, and I wrote a station tour of Union College in Schenectady, New York, and they say they're the first college radio station, which is debatable, but their first broadcasts were actually over amateur radio. And the licensing is all very confusing when you go back and try to trace it all, but they did broadcasts using music, you know, to a larger community that were done over amateur radio rather than over a licensed broadcast station. And did a lot of really cool, interesting experiments and broadcast things like music for the prom. So people like off campus could hear the music from the prom. So when I started finding stories like this, I was very intrigued and just started thinking about, well, what is college radio? You know, and we've seen that college radio has taken many forms, like and a streaming-only internet radio station could be a college radio station. A station that's broadcasting over cable TV in the 1980s, that could be a college radio station. And on and on and on. So why couldn't one of these experimental amateur stations that doesn't have an FCC license for broadcasting, like, shouldn't that count too, especially if they're doing these things that really do seem like broadcasts where many people are listening. So that became kind of a kernel of this paper. And I started thinking about how radio clubs like at Haverford and at Union College, that they're really predecessors to what we understand to be college radio. And, you know, amateur radio stations do still exist on college campuses. And for many years, they've operated in parallel with these broadcast stations. So, you know, these are, today you would see these as very separate communities, you know, very different types of people often working at these different sorts of stations. But in the 1910s, the 1920s, I think it's pretty interesting to see where that amateur work really blurred and helped to incubate student-led broadcast stations, you know, like we saw at Haverford and at Union College, which Union College did eventually have a short-lived broadcast station early on too. So I wanted to restore that history and then, you know, started digging in a bit more to find out what was happening even before that time, because we had radio experiments happening on college campuses starting in the late 1800s. And often those were done by professors in academic departments like physics. And students would play a role in that radio work and even build stations. And then, you know, soon after that, you started seeing some radio clubs, first radio clubs. And so I did some digging around in the radio community because, like, there's, you know, a lot of amazing people doing all kinds of research about the early days. And Bob Rydzewski at the California Historical Radio Society shared some really cool research with me about that was related to Robert F. Gowan, who's a radio pioneer, and he was a chief engineer for Lee DeForest, this Robert F. Gowan guy.
And who is Lee DeForest? Why is that an important name?
Lee DeForest. Well, Paul, maybe you have a better quick elevator pitch summation. I mean, he's very important to vacuum technology and vacuum tubes. I can tell you that. And he worked building early radio stations. And yeah, I don't know if you have more to say on Lee DeForest.
Yeah, I mean, he's often called the father of radio as well, though that's often, you know, sort of a contemporary of Marconi. Had his own, you know, company, the DeForest Radio and Telegraph Company. And so, you know, as well worked in broadcast. So, you know, and again, as you say, it's always hard to truly isolate the first. So many of these things happen. So many people in so many different organizations may be working on the same thing around the same time.
Yeah.
Hence why it's difficult to identify the first college radio station. Difficult to say who is the true father of radio, but Lee DeForest is certainly, you know, often cited in that same pantheon.
So this chief engineer for Lee DeForest, Robert F. Gowan, Bob Rydzewski of the California Historical Radio Society told me that Gowan started what may have been the first college radio club in the country at Harvard's Weld Hall around 1906. And so then I dug in a bit more. He shared some resources with me, and there was a 1909 issue of the Harvard Illustrated Magazine that talked about these dorm-based wireless activities. And that article said, "Finally, it became more convenient to call a fellow up by wireless and ask if he intended going to town than to walk across the yard on a personal visit." So it's similar to kind of what you hear about later. We'll maybe talk about this later on the podcast about carrier current radio. That's kind of the origin of carrier current radio, is people wanting to just sort of chat with people in another dorm room across campus. And so here at Harvard, students did some rogue experiments with wireless telegraphy from their dorm rooms. And then they formed this company called the Weld Phone Up Terograph Company of Harvard University. It's just very grand. The name means to write with winged sounds. And it was conceived of by a student in the dorm, Weld Hall, who was doing graduate studies in Greek. So anyway, it's just amazing. And Gowan wrote a 1923 article in Radio News about this, and saying the club offered wireless messages to all parts of the yard and vicinity, and that gradually stations sprang up in the different dormitories. And Rydzewski said that their enthusiasm may have resulted in Harvard instituting its first radio class. So kind of interesting to me that is an example of students' innovation driving curriculum. And you know, and I hadn't heard really these stories about student radio clubs. So to me, this was really interesting. And there's so many parallels, I think, with college radio stations. So that's why I think it's important to bring together the stories of amateur radio and broadcast radio. Couple years after that, in 1908, there was a wireless telegraph club at Columbia that was launched by students at Columbia University. And there was an article in 1908 talking about 300-foot-long wires strung 100 feet above the ground, adding that school officials were skeptical at first about letting them erect the wires for fear of disfiguring the classic beauty of the university. But despite that,
I mean, something that exists to this day that people will complain about radio antennas in that way.
Yeah. But despite all that, the professors in the electrical engineering department admitted that there was a need for wireless telegraphy coursework to be added to the curriculum. So, you know, similar to what happened at Harvard, it's like, okay, like the students are on to something, you know, we need to get with the program.
I think we can see shadows of that today. I mean, if we think about, you know, Facebook being born basically by student at Harvard, right? For better or worse, right? We have many of these stories of different innovations. Say the first, you know, truly popular and practical web browser, Mosaic, was built, you know, at the University of Illinois, essentially by students, by graduate students. You know, and I don't think that these are isolated instances. I think if we were to do some concentrated study on this idea of technological innovation on college campuses, that were in many cases forged by the students themselves. I suspect there were faculty involved or administrators involved in some way as well, right? I think very rarely is anyone operating in true isolation, but I'm certainly willing to buy that the students were the ones really pressing forward, right? The ones who, you know, being young and you know, young people in 1908 are I suspect in many ways not so different than young people today, or when I was a young person, and having a lot of boundless energy and get up and go and wanting, you know, to make something new and push the boundaries. I mean, this sounds like the story that I'm seeing here, the meta story through all of this. And so we, you know, while it took you a while to find the threads, we shouldn't be surprised that they're there.
Oh yeah, definitely. And some of this, I think, is, you know, going back to Union College, you know, this idea that they started a station in 1920, or, you know, first radio station in 1920, or first broadcast in 1920. But
where is Union College?
Schenectady, New York.
Schenectady, New York. Like you said that, yes.
Near General Electric, which is not insignificant. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when we look at these first claims, you see a lot of people kind of tearing apart that first claim, like, well, it wasn't a broadcast station, you know? So I think, again, like at the beginning, I talked about I'm interested in these underdog stations. So it's like, well, okay, it wasn't the first licensed broadcast station, but Why can't we be telling these really interesting stories about these things that are, you know, like proto broadcasts? And so actually, I want to talk a little bit about that now at Union College, just to give you a little more color. So, you know, I found some of these examples of these radio clubs in 1906, 1908. There are probably more. And we start to see more and more radio clubs being formed at various colleges. Union College, they form a radio club in 1915. And so October 14th, 1920, students broadcast a short concert of music over the radio. And the student newspaper writes about it saying, "If for the next week you hear noise a thunder every time you try to phone, you know the electric jazz experts are tuning up. And they are some jazz experts with high power spark discharges. Starting next Thursday night, the radio club will give a concert via radio. This will be a weekly habit. If at some future time you have a dance on hand and your jazz artists fail you, call up 2ADD, tell them your trouble, and if you've got a hairpin, a wire, a coil or two, and a phone, you will have all the music you wish via radio."
So I'm trying to kind of unpack that a little bit, what I'm having difficulty understanding is that, are they implicating that on the actual wired telephone, you might be getting interference from this high-powered broadcast, or is the phone the wireless itself?
It's, I don't know.
Or are they confused? Maybe they don't know how.
So calling up 2ADD, is that a telephone number, or is that...
Oh, those are the amateur letters for the station.
Okay, so that was the call letters. Okay, so then perhaps it is the case that already at Union College by 1920, there were like is explained at Harvard and such dorm radios, and so somebody was monopolizing the airspace. It's hard. Yeah, this is very interesting with not having a lot of other context to go on.
The way I read it is maybe these are some of the tools that you would use to construct your listening apparatus. So,
sure.
And then maybe there's interference on dorm phones. That's how I'm reading all of that.
Yeah. Because hairpin, a wire, and a coil or two, that they're basically describing making a foxhole radio. Crystal
so
set.
That's my... So this is done over amateur radio, and so they had this successful radio concert, you know, lots of headlines in the school newspaper saying aerial concert is the first in collegiate history. So this is where the first college radio station kind of idea comes from for Union College. So it's over amateur radio. And other headlines, ethereal recitals will be given weekly in future. I love these headlines. They're so amazing. And one of the articles said, transmitting the music from a phonograph into the receiver of a wireless telephone and then to amateur radio operators within a radius of 50 miles, members of the Union College Radio Club Thursday gave what is believed to be the first wireless musical concert of an American college organization, playing vocal and instrumental records. So, to me, this is still college radio, even though it's over amateur radio. And, you know, and I think these are really fun stories. And it's also super interesting that at Union College, these call letters to ADD, the amateur station call, those were of a radio prodigy named Wendell W. King, and he had started his own amateur station when he was 12, which is incredible. And he was also the first Black student to attend Union for a significant length of time. So, again, like, these are stories that we want to be telling about the history of college radio, that it's more, there's more going on in these early days than people might recognize. You know, it's more diverse. It's as far as like the ways people broadcast, the people who are broadcasting. And King had been involved with amateur radio since 1911. One article said he might have been the most technically proficient student connected with early Union radio. He'd already been president of the Troy Amateur Radio Club, had served in the Army Signal Corps, and had worked for the radio section of General Electric. So, you know, pretty inspiring stories.
Yeah, that's really amazing. So that's Wendell W. King, you said?
Yep. Yep. And he was, his calls were to ADD. And so, yeah, just like wanting to tell these stories. And then the radio club at Union kept doing these Thursday night music broadcasts over amateur radio. And then they eventually had an experimental station, too. So this is why it's like really hard to do this research, because it's like, okay, am I writing about which radio station am I writing about now? So they did broadcast over an experimental station, 2XQ, that it got a license for in 1919.
So that's a broadcast station, mm-hmm. experimental broadcast station. Okay.
Yeah. So now it's doing kind of both. It got letters. Amazingly, I got to visit Union College and the archives, and I got to see their radio scrapbook. So I was able to read all sorts of letters. They got letters from listeners who read in to report hearing and enjoying the music transmissions. The stations did stunts. They outfitted a baby carriage with a radio set. amazing photos of that in the archives. They broadcast radio church services.
Is that only because, is that to make it mobile? Is that, yeah. You know, in that, yeah. Probably a baby carriage was the easiest thing they could find, I suspect.
Yeah,
to AV make it. AV cards hadn't yet been invented.
Yep. It's pretty funny. Yes, they did church services over the air, playing hymns played over a phonograph, and then also songs by a college quartet. In 1921, they did, I mentioned this earlier, the wireless transmission of the junior prom music. And ahead of before the prom, their student newspaper reported that the music of Ford Dabney's syncopated orchestra of Ziegfeld Midnight Frolic fame will be heard as far west as Nebraska and by ships far out at sea. And the prom went from 10:30 p.m. until 6 a.m. And so that's when they were broadcasting this music, you know, for folks to hear across the land. And so that's also amazing to me to think about these overnight proms and radio overnight. So, you know, early stories here of college radio. And then they did eventually get, at Union, they were one of the first colleges to obtain a limited commercial license to operate a broadcast station. So WRL was issued in March 1922, and they held that license until 1924. And only a few other stations operating at colleges or universities obtained this type of broadcast license earlier than that. University of Minnesota and University of Wisconsin obtained that type of license in January 1922, and Union was in March 1922. So trying to get all the details straight, you know, on all these different types of licenses as I do this research. But, you know, the underlying thing that I think is important is just talking about the activities that were happening and that these were mm-hmm. broadcasts, no matter what type of station they were on.
I think that extra context is really important, actually, Jennifer, as you've added, right? Because you've kind of taken this, I think, I think I'm guilty of making this assumption. You sort of, I assume it's sort of, you know, geeks in a basement somewhere, right? Or geeks in an attic somewhere. But what I'm hearing is a far, it sounds like far more integrated practice into the campus, into campus life. You know, and I'm sure again that took a while, years in fact, to take root. But I think that gives furthermore greater reason to accept your proposal that the early experiments were true college radio, because it was not an isolated experiment. You know, they may have been experimental because the technology in some ways might have been considered experimental, but that it was truly intended to sort of integrate with the campus community and outside the campus community, right? To take advantage of the very fact that radio has loose boundaries to a campus.
And with alumni, and, you know, that was really important at Haverford College, that a lot of the kind of accounting of the station activities in the 1920s talked about, you know, activities and lectures and messages of Haverford College could be heard for thousands of miles in every direction, so that alumni could stay connected to the school. So yeah, very much so. And on that connections tip, something that was super exciting for me looking through these scrapbooks at Union College was reading all the letters that came from people at other colleges and other college radio clubs. And so I dug into this more, and the Union College Radio Club was really actively engaged with other college radio clubs, and lots of correspondence in this scrapbook in the 1920s. There was a letter from the CCNY Radio Club at the College of the City of New York, and in December 1920, they wrote a letter saying, "Fellow radio bugs, we were more than pleased to receive your communication on the 14th. Your suggestion interests us very much, and we would like to cooperate with you in furthering an intercollegiate radio organization of some sort." So there was this interest brewing in making connections. And later in January 1921, there was a letter from a Union College alumnus that said, "The Union College Club is trying to foster an intercollegiate system of communication by wireless. A large number of schools here in the East have signified a desire to participate in such a schedule, and the college here is already installing a more powerful set." So these kernels of thinking beyond the campus, and, you know, think about it. You know, now we have the internet and we can communicate with everybody all over the land immediately. But, you know, people in radio clubs through their amateur radio were able to send messages to people thousands of miles away and start building these connections. And, you know, I also saw things in the archives about news sharing, that could be a way to quickly get news to other student newspapers too at other college campuses.
You are listening to Radio Survivor. The voice you just heard is Jennifer Waits, one of our co-conspirators here at Radio Survivor. But she is enlightening us about some of the very early history of college radio, complicating a lot of received history, bringing in a perspective on amateur radio and showing how early radio experiments that may have not been strictly broadcast probably qualify as college radio because, in fact, these folks had audiences and intended to reach an audience and engage the campus community and communities far beyond the boundaries of any given campus. I'm Paul Riesmandel. Also with us is Eric Klein, and we can be found online at radiosurvivor.com, where The show can be heard as a podcast, as well as on dozens of community and college radio stations around North America. So Jennifer, that is sort of you've complicated now this history, you know, going back to starting in the late 19th century, well into the early 20th century. And then I think, you know, college radio, it seems, as we kind of know it, student-run radio stations, seems like took a stronger foothold in those years subsequent, right? And part of that is radio takes a stronger foothold, basically, in the United States. You know, in 1934, we had the creation of the Federal Communications Commission. 1927 is the creation of the Federal Radio Commission, you know, and it becomes, of course, also more quickly commercialized, right? And large radio networks like NBC, the National Broadcasting Company owned by RCA, begin to really, you know, take hold of the public's imagination, and radio becomes a popular entertainment as well as a popular communication. But college radio was there afoot, was it not?
Yeah, well, so by the end of the 1920s, a lot of stations left the air that were licensed to colleges. So we had maybe a large number that dwindled. So we weren't left with very many, you know, in these stations.
Do you know why that is? I mean, there's a lot of changes happening. I mean, I suspect maybe the Radio Act of 1927 might have something to do with it, but I don't have.
I wonder if the Great Depression.
I don't have that history available to me right off the top of my head, unfortunately.
And I wonder if the economy had anything to do with it.
Of course, yes. I'm sorry. Yes, as we entered the Depression a few years later.
Yeah. So things were like kind of Wild West, and you know, like at Haverford, they were broadcasting at 1,000. You could hear it 1,000 miles in every direction at one point, WABQ, and, you know, it was kind of crazy. And so things got, like, reined in, and commercial, you know, large commercial companies were more interested in having stations, and the dial was getting crowded, and, you know, people were having to kind of share that space. And so at Haverford, anyway, they were approached by a commercial group who bought the license. So a station in Philadelphia then took over. And so that was sort of a common refrain, that the dial was, you know, less of these, fewer of these types of stations like existed by the end of the 1920s that were, well, there weren't that many that were run by students, but fewer stations at colleges in general existed when we came to the end of the 1920s. And then things were pretty quiet. So I think on a lot of these college campuses, people then kind of people who were interested in radio then focused on amateur radio again, and code classes, teaching Morse code and sending messages to people all over the country. But then by the late 1930s, students at Brown University came up with a plan to broadcast just to the campus only using this carrier current idea, where you're broadcasting using infrastructure of the building as the antennas. So they called them gas pipe networks because, you know, in the dorms there were gas pipes, and so they were able to kind of use that to get their signal out. And the stories about that are very similar to the stories I was telling at the beginning of this episode about these amateur radio operators who were students who were setting up these amateur stations so they could communicate like across the yard or from dorm room to dorm room. That's kind of like what carrier current was like starting in the late 1930s, where initially it was students in a dorm who maybe wanted to share their record collection with another friend, and so they set up communication so they could broadcast it to another room. And then that quickly got more organized, and those students at Brown formed the Intercollegiate Broadcasting System, which was a college radio organization, and they helped teach other people how to build these stations on their college campuses, and that really, word of that spread, And I was just looking today at an article written in the Saturday Evening Post in 1941 about these stations, Radiator Pipe Broadcasters by Eric Barnow. And you know, he's talking about, you know, these college administrators who are hearing these strange sounds on the radio and where are they coming from? And it's a very delightful article about the birth of what, you know, some people call campus radio. Some people, and another accounting of the history of that, the gas pipe networks by Lewis Block. He really sees that as the beginning of college radio. Mm-hmm. The college radio began with Carrier Current. So again, like, I think he wrote his book in 1980, reflecting back on these gas pipe networks that started late 1930s. But he's another person where I'm like, but what about the 20s, dude?
Well, you know, I mean, it's very plausible that he didn't have access to any materials. I mean, yeah. You know, as it is, as you know, doing history, it's often about, it is about finding threads and then pulling on them. And you can look for a long time. And if you don't know what you're looking for, right, until you stumble upon something you didn't expect. Right. I wonder what documentation, you know, I mean, you've worked pretty hard to find this various documentation. And I suspect at least some of this has been aided by having access to the internet, even though we're talking about, you know, 100-year-old archival materials. Some of this, there are breadcrumbs at the very least available online, even though you've then made additional efforts to, say, travel to Schenectady, New York. Right. And to follow up on this. But if, you know, how did you find that thread even to know to go there? In 1980, some of this research would have simply been, practically speaking, more difficult to do.
Yeah. And I mean, and also the history of these campus only stations starting in the late 30s, Carrier Current stations, is really important. And I think I also want to be, even though I'm kind of like joking at like having a beef with him because he didn't talk about the 20s, I think it's, this is another story that really isn't told enough about how significant it was that students could create their own stations that didn't have to be licensed by the FCC.
And that's an important point, I think, because I, you know, again, you know, with the Radio Act of 1934, the licensing of radio stations became much more consolidated and I believe much more difficult. Than it had been previously. And so I suspect that simply getting that authorization in 1920 at Union College was from then it would have been the Commerce Department is who would have given you that authorization. The Federal Radio Commission did not exist. The Federal Communications Commission didn't exist. There were probably fewer people looking for radio licenses. That was probably easier to get. Yeah. Than the hoops that might have needed to be jumped through in order to get a license in 1935 or later, right? So the fact that there was an ability and a technology to build out a radio station that only required the technical competency provided that, you know, and making it clear that if you could build a Carrier Current radio station, you could build a radio station that could be heard off campus, right?
Yeah.
But it is, you know, students taking advantage of, you know, sort of, for lack of a better way of putting it, a loophole in the law that allows very limited distance transmissions. Offhand, I don't know when the rules for Carrier Current were written into the federal regulations, so I don't know if that's something in 1934 or not, if that was extant. You know, these things get written in as time goes on, and today we consider it under the rubric of Part 15 broadcasting. Part 15, which is really actually a part of the federal rules, which cover unintended transmissions and interference. So when you broadcast under Part 15, what you're really doing is basically broadcasting something that qualifies as interference, and there's a maximum amount of power that can be used or maximum distance it can go, depending on what radio band you're broadcasting in. And that's basically what they're taking advantage of is that as a loophole, they may emit a signal that doesn't go very far. And at some point, I know the rules were updated specifically for colleges, saying that they could broadcast provided the signal stayed on campus.
And it was fun kind of looking back at this 1941 article. I'd seen it before, but looking at it again today, and it talks about how on some of the campuses, the faculty have kind of like really kind of, you know, are buying into the station and have even used some of the programming. Like there's some, you know, classical music programs that might have been assigned by a music appreciation class, you know, which I thought that was interesting, like, you know, giving a little glimpse of the programming. And also that there were things that some of the carry current stations did that might have been kind of, you know, on the edge. So the Harvard station did an interview with a burlesque star on the art of the striptease. So again, it's kind of breaking some of these stereotypes. You know, another research question that's been asked of me is about the origins of freeform, and I like to think that some of that is with it, that freeform programming, experimental programming, where you're playing a bunch of different genres or doing weird things on the air, reading poetry. You know, I think a lot of that was happening in college radio, and it's impossible to research every single station, but I love hearing mm-hmm. these little kernels of things that, you know, in 1941, there were campus radio stations interviewing burlesque stars. So, you know, it's not just the music to study by or the lectures or, you know, some of the things that you might have expected. So I hope to find more and more of these studies as I find more stations to research. And, you know, and if any listeners know about student-run stations in the 1920s that I don't know about, I hope that you'll reach out to us, because, you know, I love uncovering more and more examples of what was happening at that time. And it's a very, very laborious process.
Send us an email, podcast@radiosurvivor.com. Tell us the stories that you know about college radio history. I don't think there's any story we don't want to hear.
I know.
I'll go out on that limb.
And I want to flash to today a little bit. Last week we talked about the low power FM opportunity coming up starting November 1st, 2023 in the United States. And I know there are some college stations who are going to apply and looking into that, but, you know, want to put that out there into the ether, as they said back then.
So an opportunity to get a relatively easy application for a licensed FM radio station operating at 100 watts maximum. So intended to serve a relatively small area, but a campus certainly can certainly serve a campus very well, serve a small town, serve many neighborhoods within a larger city or metropolitan area. And that window opens up. And by window, we mean there's this defined period in which the FCC will accept applications for one of these stations. And it is only during this period that you can submit these applications. So you need to be prepared. And it is coming up. I did not place the numbers in front of me. It's in November.
Yeah, and Radio Survivor has done two recent episodes. You can find us online at radiosurvivor.com. Go over to the podcast tab. And twice in the last few weeks, we have talked about both the technical requirements or things you should be aware of if you're looking forward to low power FM, or if you're interested in applying, as well as our most recent episode prior to this one. We had a wonderful at length interview with the expert on low power FM who wrote the book Low Power FM for Dummies about applying for and building and sustaining low power FM radio stations.
Yeah, thanks to Sharon Scott of Art FM, and which is also WXOX LP in Louisville, Kentucky, who whipped out this low power FM Radio for Dummies book,
right,
you know, just in time for this application window.
And of course, we here at Radio Survivor, we're always excited if you out there in the listening area, in the listening audience, have this desire or yearning to apply for low power FM radio and get it done. But you know, we are also excited about sitting back and listening to what other people accomplish. And as audience, as members of an audience who love radio, which obviously all of our listeners are in that audience, like this new low power FM window is an exciting, it's an exciting moment in the history of radio in the United States. And it's coming up again. And we're very excited about all of the new radio stations that are going to be popping up.
And we always have to emphasize that if you're interested at all in putting a non-commercial, very important, non-commercial community or college radio station on the air with low power FM, now is the time to mobilize, because we do not know if or when another window opportunity will happen. And part of this is purely practical. There's only so many spaces on the dial, even for these small, low-powered stations. Eventually, the dial fills up in most communities. And so I can go out again. I'm going to go out on a limb and say, in the event that there is another low-power FM window, it's unlikely to happen again for another decade, because that's about the first one was in the year 2000. The second one was in the year 2013. It is now 2023. So it is probably a decade in the future. And there will be even fewer licenses, fewer frequency opportunities available at that point. So now is the time to mobilize. The window opens November 1st. We have lots and lots of resources on our website at radiosurvivor.com. You can click on our LPFM menu or look at the last couple of podcasts that we've done on the subject if you want to learn more and kind of dive in. It is not too late, but the time to motivate is now.
Yeah. Oh, yes. And similarly, if you want to dive more into college radio history, we have a college radio section on the website. I tour stations all over the country. You can read my tours at Union College and other places. The most recent tours have an extra hefty dose of college radio history. I want to wish everybody a happy College Radio Day as well. And I was excited that the three of us were able to come together in celebration of College Radio Day on this episode, too.
When is College Radio Day?
October 6th. This is the 13th College Radio Day. World College Radio Day is what it's called now. So stations, college radio stations, campus radio stations from all over the world are celebrating. There will be a simulcast where every hour a different radio station will be highlighted, and that will be on the College Radio Day website. We'll have links in our show notes. And, you know, it's really a time when stations come together to remind the world that college radio is still alive and well and interesting.
That's really cool. Well, you've been listening to Radio Survivor here on the radio stations where we are broadcast, or perhaps as a podcast online at radiosurvivor.com. All the resources mentioned today and also all of the other resources are all on that website, radiosurvivor.com. We'd love to hear from you if you want to email us. Our email address is podcast@radiosurvivor.com. On behalf of Paul Riesmandel and Jennifer Waits, Jennifer, who produced today's episode, my name is Eric Klein. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll see you next week.